This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Earl Wright. Today is August 18, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Wright is joining me by phone from California. All right, why don't we begin, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
All right, I was a true World War II baby.
Okay.
I was born in New Philadelphia, Ohio.
Okay.
And how that happened, my dad was in the Army Air Corps, and in late in the war, World War II, he was moved to a small airfield in Central California and preparing to go to the Pacific. He was a tail gunner on a B-25.
Okay.
And he liked to hang out in bars. And this one bar was across the street from where my mother worked. And she would go over daily to have coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And they met. And he would, you know, he would talk the pilot into buzzing the place she worked and that sort of thing. And it blossomed into a romance. And then she became pregnant with me. They got married. The war ended. And he had worked for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. So she followed him to Ohio, where he was, you know, he resumed that job.
Okay.
But I was born in December. You know, it's cold in Ohio.
Right.
He spent most of his off hours of drinking with his brothers and his dad, who also worked for the railroad. She said, I'm sick of this. So I was 6 weeks old when I moved to California.
Okay.
And I grew up in a little called Kingsburg, basically a Swedish town, a lot of Swedish immigrants.
Right.
I actually, my dad worked at several places as a maintenance mechanic. And during my sixth and seventh grade years, he took a job up in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I lived in Hayward for those 2 years.
Okay.
Then eventually moved back to Kingsburg and graduated from Kingsburg High School in 1963. Two of my best friends had quit school after our junior year. One joined the Navy and the other joined the Army. And, I'll go back. They were gone. And so, one of my peripheral friends, I ended up hanging around with him because we job shared.
Mm-hmm.
We worked at a service station after school on Highway 99. And, we would work every other day.
Okay.
And we started college at the Sequoias in Visalia and quickly grew bored with it. And so one day he says, let's go talk to the Army recruiter. I said, yeah, I'm bored, why not? So we did, and we signed the papers to go in on the buddy system.
Okay.
The night before we were to catch the bus and leave for boot camp, he called me and said, I'm not going.
Oh, no.
And I said, well, I am.
Right.
And as an aside, has little to do with me other than he didn't follow through on the buddy system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about 5 or 6 weeks into boot camp, and I get a telephone call. And it's him. He's in a company across the street a couple of weeks behind me.
Mm.
And he had received a visit. And if I recall correctly, it might have been it might have been someone that said, young man, you signed this contract.
Right.
Better go. Turns out he got into the Army, didn't like being enlisted, but he requested OCS, got it, went to Vietnam, won a Silver Star.
Hmm.
So he got any assignment he wanted, so he wanted to fly helicopters, so he learned to fly helicopters, went back to Vietnam as a Cobra pilot, ended up, he spent 20 years and retired as a major.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which I thought was funny for the guy who didn't want to go in the first
place. Right, right.
Right. Anyway, so I went through boot camp at Fort Ord.
Okay.
And I had enlisted airborne unassigned, but I wore really, really thick glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came to me during boot camp and had me sign something that basically released the Army from its obligation to send me to airborne school.
Mm-hmm.
I was 17 years old. What did I know?
Right.
And so I signed it. I learned later that I could have waived the glasses requirement. And to this day, I wish I would have. But, you know, I got well beyond that. So anyway, I go to Fort Gordon, Georgia, go to radio relay carrier operator school.
Right. Okay.
And really, I don't know, I was bored with it too. But, you know, I did fine in the school.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it took a while. I had graduated, and I was still hanging around there without orders. And finally, I got orders for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a vague notion of where Vietnam was, but I had to call my mother and say, get the atlas out and tell me where I'm going.
Right.
And it was early 1964, and I actually arrived there in April. But this is, you know, still late February, early March.
Right.
And I finally, you know, get the orders, and I'm sent to Oakland Army Terminal. And I get there, and there are guys that have been there for days that haven't got transportation out. And I'm thinking to myself, well, these guys are helicopter mechanics and that sort of thing. You know, I'm going to be here forever.
Right.
Well, I look, you know, every day you're supposed to check the posting board and see if you're assigned to go out. I looked on the posting board, and I'm on a flight the next day.
Mm, wow.
And I flew on a C-135, which you sit in jump seats backwards. There's no windows to the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically takes 2 days to get there. We stopped in Honolulu, stopped on Wake Island, stopped then overnight in the Philippines, and then from you know, what used to be Clark Air Base on to Saigon.
Right. Okay.
All right. Arrived in Saigon at a basically an in processing location. I spent one full day there, and it was really interesting. There were only 16,000 Americans in country at that time.
Mm, right.
So we were still a novelty.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the kids I had gone through boot camp with, I saw him in Saigon. And so we went out to have a beer together, and he happened to be a redhead. And the Vietnamese were just nuts over his red hair. They'd never seen red hair.
Right.
And so they would want to touch his head, see if it was real.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so one day in Saigon, and it was really funny. That's where the term greenies came in for the new guys.
Okay.
Because our fatigues were, you know, bright green.
Right.
And the guys going out were really faded green.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately the new guys all wanted to have faded fatigue. Because, you know, you were really obvious that you were a new guy.
Right.
So I got orders or posts. I'm not sure how, but the next day I got a C-123 to Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to remember, I had just turned 18. And you know, an 18-year-old, you don't ask questions. You just go where you're told to go. And so I had no clue why I was headed to Da Nang. So
mm-hmm. Right.
I get up there, and it's the 178th Signal Company. Okay, right. That makes sense, because I've been trained as a radio relay carrier operator.
Okay.
And I check in. they say, well, we'll have something for you tomorrow, but in the meantime, go with this guy. And so they loaded me and a couple other guys on a deuce and a half, take us out to the rice paddies, and we pick up rocket pods off of Huey's. I guess after they fire the rockets, they drop the pods that the rockets are in. And we're picking them up, and they're covered with big, ugly leeches and that sort of thing. That was my first exposure to the boonies.
Right.
It was kind of like, ooh.
Right,
it
sure.
It was a whole lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, next day, I spent probably less than a day in Da Nang. Catch another 123. I've been assigned to the 22nd Advisory Group in Kontum.
Okay.
Well, everybody around the orderly room, oh, Kontum, oh, you're going to Indian country.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 2 months prior, maybe the month prior, three sappers had got through the wire at Kontum and blew up what they thought was a very important hooch because they'd seen a lot of officers hanging around the hooch. Well, it turned out what they blew up was the officer's club.
Okay.
And one of the NCOs there had, it may have been the guard NCO, I'm not sure, shot and killed one of the sappers, and the other two got back out through the wire.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I get there, and, you know, because of that incident, tension's pretty high. And the type of radios I was trained to operate, basically you get them up and running and they run.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do anything with them.
Okay.
So believe it or not, Jason, I did not learn until 2008 that, number one, I thought I was assigned to the to MACV, to the 22nd Advisory Group. I was
mm-hmm.
spent a year with them, so I always thought I was part of them.
Right.
And it turned out I was basically a shooter. I was always, a little explanation here.
Okay.
There were probably 70 Americans in the 22nd Advisory Group.
Okay.
And the majority of them were officers.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically they were advisors.
Right.
I thought I was an advisor, you know, part of their team. Well, I wasn't.
Okay.
But because there were so few lower-ranking enlisted men, I drew guard duty every other night.
Oh, man.
Plus convoy duty. Anything that required a shooter.
Right.
You know, we were it.
Right.
And my basic dress every day included my M14 with a magazine
mm-hmm.
in with a round chamber. If you were inside the wire, the safety was on. If you were outside the wire, the safety was off.
Mm-hmm.
100 rounds of ammunition and 4 fragmentation grenades.
Okay.
And basically, that's how I lived for a year.
All right.
Well, I did not. There was an incident one night. I was in a foxhole, and something was eating me alive, but it's black. I can't see anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I got on the horn, and I called into the command post. I said, something's eating me alive. I got to get out of here. And they said, come in. I got in, and under the light, they actually had an MD doctor, not just a, you know,
not just a medic.
And he took one look at me, and he turned pale. And I looked, and I'm covered in fire ants.
Oh, man.
And so they had, the doc shot me full of something, and they called for a medevac.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the doc got me stabilized in the medevac in weather. And so they never did evacuate me.
Mm-hmm.
But I during my life, I've had severe problems with apple juice.
Mm-hmm.
In my 40s, I became allergic to shellfish. In my 50s, I became allergic to bee stings. And it just gets worse and worse. So I filed a claim with the VA. And mm-hmm. if you've probably heard some of the history of the VA.
Right.
They have a really, really good healthcare system and a really, really asshole bunch on the claim side.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So, yeah.
Right.
So they made me find all my records.
Mm-hmm.
They were no help whatsoever. And it took me 2 years to find my records. Basically, what they were saying is, well, you couldn't have been in combat because you were a 178 signal company. I said, no, I was with the 22nd MACV advisory group.
Right.
Turns out, long story short, I finally found this wonderful woman in Indianapolis who found my pay records from that period.
Hmm.
And the reason I wanted my pay records, hostile fire pay was not automatic until 1966.
Okay.
So in 64 and 65, you had to be exposed to hostile fire 6 times a month, and that had to be certified by an officer.
Hmm. Okay.
I knew I drew hostile fire pay every month I was there.
Right.
In 64 and 5, so if I could get my hands on those pay records, I could prove that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she got them. She found them.
Right.
And sent them to me. And I did not realize what my job title was until I got those pay records, and it was armed guard.
Oh, wow. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And the claim still hasn't been resolved by the VA, by the way.
Uh-huh.
It's been since January 2008.
Mm, right.
So I've lost track. Some of the things I wanted to point out.
Okay.
My first tour in Vietnam was fun. It's difficult to explain. I don't know if you've been in combat. Maybe you understand.
No, I haven't.
You're 18 years old. You're invincible.
Mm-hmm, right?
Nothing's going to happen, and you get to play with all these wonderful toys.
Right.
I mean, it was just a ball. We were in the Central Highlands. Basically jungle. The weather was pretty nasty up there, so a lot of times aircraft couldn't get in. So to get away from that feeling of isolation, mail was very important.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with a ton of officers, they wanted their mail, so we would run convoys from there down to Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
To pick up mail. So, you know, there were times I'd make 2 or 3 convoys to Pleiku.
Right.
During a week. And it was basically all the young enlisted men and usually one sergeant. And we would have a machine gun jeep in front, a machine gun jeep in back, and then either a 2.5 or 3/4 ton truck in the middle. And we would just fly down Highway 1 and then zoom back up.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, there was just always a feeling of danger, you know, because basically anything around Kantu was hostile.
Okay.
And so it was almost like in Cowboys and Indians as kids.
Right.
My first real exposure to the death and destruction was July 4th, I believe it was, 64. And with the 22nd Advisory Group, we also had a Special Forces B team.
Okay.
And that B team had 5 A teams it was responsible for that were out along the border. I believe it was Laos and Cambodia border, and then with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of the A teams was attacked and overrun, and I believe it was July 4th, 64. I'd have to look it up, but
okay.
We quickly formed a relief group. Basically, I think it was 2 companies of Vietnamese. And I'm going to guess 10 Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we went and, well, I can't say we rescued them because the fight was over when we got there. We helped, know, police up the bodies and kind of get things back in order. Had a C-123 drop concertina wire that we helped string and replace around their compound. And mostly mountain yards. Contoum and the highlands up around there, a lot of mountain yard villages.
Mm-hmm.
And mountain yards hated the Viet Cong. Basically, the mountain yards hated the Vietnamese because the Vietnamese treated them so poorly.
Right.
So they were allied with the Americans, and the special forces had really good luck, arming them and training them and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there were a lot of things that went on. That was probably the most memorable.
Right.
Was when that village and A team got overrun.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In fact, the AR-15, which became the M-16, were so new that the Special Forces guys pitched theirs in the river so the Viet Cong wouldn't get them.
Okay.
Because it was obvious the camp was being overrun. In fact, their the bad guys got inside the wire and turned machine guns on the team house.
Oh, wow.
And, it got pretty nasty for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I got to see Bob Hope.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was that was quite a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas 64 is coming.
Right.
Bob Hope's going to be in country. Closest to us is going to be in Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we heard he's coming, but we couldn't go. Then we were going, then we weren't going. At the last second, they said, okay, put together a convoy, we're going.
Right.
Who can be freed up is going to go. Well, here they held it at the 52nd Aviation Battalion. In fact, I've seen pictures on the internet that have the banner behind them saying the 52nd Aviation Battalion, so I know I was there.
Mm-hmm.
We come zooming in, just armed to the teeth, and all the Pleiku guys are unarmed because, it's pretty safe around there.
Right.
And Hope even made a comment about us when we got there.
Oh, really?
And I don't remember much else about the show, but I know we had a good time, and I was a big fan of Bob Hope's, because of his USO tours, so
mm-hmm.
that was really enjoyable.
Right, right. All right. Well, I've got some follow-up questions for you, if you don't mind, from what you've covered up to this point.
Okay.
All right. If we could back up a little ways, I've got a few questions about, first of all, your decision to, a little bit more about your decision to join the Army. What was your motivation for joining? Was it just something to do as an adventure, or I guess if you could talk a little bit more about that, about why you decided to join.
Okay. On my father's side, everybody had been in the military.
Okay.
And it was almost like I knew at some point I was going to go into the military
mm-hmm.
in my life. And, because I was, had started college and was bored with it.
Okay.
I said, when my friend Joe had mentioned it, I said, hey, that sounds like a great idea. Let's chat with him.
Mm-hmm.
And although I was young and a little bit of in awe of the drill instructor, the senior drill instructor, it was fun. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was absolutely fun. I grew up, playing outside, having quad fights in the neighborhood, playing sports. Boot camp came easy to me.
Mm-hmm.
There were some guys that you'd go on a run and they were dying, or you'd have to do chin-ups and they could barely do one. Hell, I could do chin-ups all day.
Right.
You know, so I had a good time. Mm-hmm. And I actually, that's only a short, I was in 5 years, 10 months, 23 days, but who's counting?
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
Of that time, there was probably only a short period I didn't enjoy what I was doing.
Okay. All right. Well, prior to joining, had you paid much attention to what was going on in the world with U.S. foreign policy, the Cold War? I know you mentioned that that you asked your mom just exactly where Vietnam was.
I was a teenager. Uh-huh. I didn't care.
Right. Right.
I had no clue.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I knew there was a president. I knew there was a cabinet. And I knew there was a Congress. I knew there was a Supreme Court. I knew there was a foreign policy. I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really care what it was.
Right. Okay.
It was interesting. Something I should probably slip in there. I was in boot camp when Kennedy was assassinated.
Okay.
And our drill instructor immediately said, well, we're going to war. And I'm thinking, holy crap.
Mm, right.
Who does he mean going to war with? And I assumed they're the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I guess I was aware of some things.
Right. Right. All right. I have a few more questions about BASIC, if you don't mind. Could you talk, I guess, a little bit about the training itself? Did you feel that it, I guess, sufficiently prepared you as best it could for military life and for service in Vietnam?
I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
But that's because I enjoyed it, so I took seriously.
Mm-hmm.
There were my platoon included a lot of draftees.
Okay.
Some of whom took it seriously, some of whom didn't. You know, I'm not sure how the ones who didn't take it seriously would have answered the question you just asked.
Right.
Whether it was them or not. But I was used to guns. I was used to sleeping on the ground. I mean, you know, that was things I did for fun.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, for instance, I fired expert on qualification day.
Okay.
And the senior drill instructor was just tickled pink because he was used to 17-year-olds being kind of the screw-ups
mm-hmm.
of the world.
Right.
And, I fired expert just, you know, I just kind of natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up, slapped me on the back, way to go, that sort of thing.
Right.
And I was scared to death of him, so that was quite a compliment.
Right. Well, that brings up another question I had for you. If you could talk a little bit more about the drill instructors and your impressions of those guys.
I knew you were going to get there. All right. The senior drill instructor, as I explained to you, I was scared to death of him. I loved him.
Mm-hmm.
He was just the most squared away person I ever met in my life. And where I grew up, there were only two black families. And so I know a whole lot of black about it, you know, but I had friends who were black.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy was black. And, I mean, like I said, I was scared to death of him and loved him at the same time. The guy was the most squared-away soldier I've ever met in my life.
Right.
Now, my particular platoon sergeant had no respect for him at all. He was a total loser.
Mm.
He was a World War II E5, which, if he couldn't get past E5 in 20-something years,
right.
That tells you what a loser he was. So I had no respect for him whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And basically we operated despite him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other drill instructor, the one that you said that you were you admired but were also afraid of, was he a combat veteran as well, or do you know?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
In fact, I heard later that he was killed in Vietnam, but I don't know that as a fact.
Mm-hmm.
I just ran into one of the guys, you know, from the platoon later.
Right. All right. Well, any other memorable moments or funny moments, anything like that from boot camp that stick out in your mind?
No, I mean, I pretty much what I was told and exceeded, you know, what was expected of me, just because that was the kind of person I am, and
mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and it came easy to me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, once you got that next assignment for advanced training at Fort Gordon with the radios, I know that you seem to think that wasn't what you really wanted to do. What was your reaction when you got that assignment?
Again, you know, when you're 18 years old, you do what you're told.
Right.
Throughout my military career, I was always highly superiors, and you know they recommended schools to me and this and that and the other thing. Well, the only time I ever really got in trouble was going through school.
Okay.
In Fort Gordon. And basically, one of the guys in my platoon was older. He's 22, I believe, from Philadelphia, who hung out in gin mills. I didn't know what a gin mill was.
Right.
And one day he invited me to take the bus into town and head over to South Carolina because you could drink at 18, drink
okay.
beer at 18.
Right.
So we go to South Carolina. And we spend the afternoon drinking beer, and we walk back to Augusta.
Right.
And have to walk across the river. And he says, "Hey, watch me piss in two states at once." And he jumps up on the bridge before I know what's happening.
Right.
And we were not off of that bridge before we were in a paddy wagon.
Oh, wow.
And took us down. Actually, we were the first they put into the paddy wagon, so they spent the rest of the time picking up hookers and pimps and all kinds of ne'er-do-wells. Filled that paddy wagon with it.
Right.
Like, how did I get myself into this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got an Article 15 out of it. And the company commander, he cracks me up. It doesn't sound like a whole lot of money, but when you're making $78 a month, he says, "I'm fining you $10 for being drunk, and I'm fining you another 10 for hanging around with Monahan."
Right.
That was the only time I was in trouble.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I actually didn't want to do that again.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, could you talk, I guess, just a little bit about that training you received there at Fort Gordon and what it was like?
Let's see. Basically, these were cabinet-sized radios.
Think okay.
of a four-drawer file cabinet.
Okay.
They're basically about that size. And what they did is supported telephone communication.
Okay.
So you'd have a set of these radios on one end connected to phone lines, and then a set of the same radios on the other end connected to phone lines, and then, you know, people could communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it was a lot of reading how they operated, and once you dialed in the frequencies, the only thing that could go wrong is you would change out components.
Okay.
So, I mean, I could do it. I wasn't really interested in it, but I never, other than school, believe it or not, Jason,
mm-hmm.
I never worked on those radios.
Really?
Again. Nope.
Right. All right. How long did that training last?
Okay, let's see. I believe it was 2 months.
Okay.
Let's say 10 weeks. 10 weeks sounds more reasonable.
Okay. All right. And once that training was over with, that's whenever you got the assignment to Vietnam?
Correct.
Okay. What was your reaction to being assigned to Vietnam?
I was pretty excited.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen Vietnam mentioned in the newspaper. I had heard it occasionally mentioned on TV news. I was, headed somewhere where the happenings were.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, although I wasn't exactly sure where in the world it was, I knew this is where the news was being made, and I was going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. And so you left in April of 64, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. How did you get over there? Was it a civilian airliner? No, you told me. I'm sorry. That's right.
Right.
I remember.
It was C-135.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting point on that. I've never been able to confirm it was the same aircraft, but it was exactly a week behind us, the aircraft making that flight. On approach into Clark Air Base in the Philippines, struck a tanker truck, exploded, and killed everyone on board.
Oh, wow.
And I go, man, somebody was looking out for me,
mm-hmm.
To get me on the flight a week before that happened.
Right, right. Right. Well, go ahead.
You can go on the internet and find the tail number of the one that crashed, but I didn't know the tail number of the one I was on.
Mm-hmm.
But, it may have been the same aircraft
mm-hmm.
making its return trip.
Right, right. All right. Once you arrived in country, what was your first impression of Vietnam?
Man, is it hot.
Right.
And muggy.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the Central Valley, so heat's not a big thing. I mean, in the summer, it's typically over 100 here.
Mm-hmm.
But we're real dry. We've got humidity probably in the 23% range. Well, Vietnam, the humidity runs up to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And even arriving in April, man, that's the first thing that hits you. You walk out of an airplane and just go, wow,
mm-hmm.
what was that? And, the Air Force lives well. They live in concrete barracks with air conditioning. Well, the Army lives in hooches, which are basically tents with floors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stinking hot.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess a little bit more on that subject there about Khantoum and what the base there looked like. You mentioned the quarters, but the housing,
okay.
The food, and all of that.
The U.S. base back then was located right on Highway 1, and highway is almost a misnomer if you're familiar with one-lane country roads
mm-hmm.
in America.
Right.
You know what Highway 1 looks like.
Okay.
Basically surrounded by two layers of wire. One was the chain link fence, and then concertina wire.
Mm-hmm.
And as the year went on and the war escalated, it wasn't escalating much. From the time I got there, there were 16,000 Americans in country, and by the time I left, there were 21,000 Americans in country, so it's not a whole lot. But you got to remember there were a lot of incidents that happened during that time. The Maddox and the Turner Joy were allegedly attacked by North Vietnamese torpedo boats. Mm-hmm. But in August of 64, you know, we did retaliatory strikes. When was it? Oh, yeah. February 65, the VC attacked Pleiku. Mm-hmm. And basically overran it. A lot of the helicopters from the 52nd Aviation Battalion were able to get off the ground, and they brought them up to us on Kontumum, and hid them is probably a misnomer, but that's basically what we did, is we hid them.
Okay.
Because we thought we were going to get it. I mean, the next logical place to hit was us, and we thought we were going to get attacked. But as all of these incidents were going on during that year I was there, we went from standard foxholes, which you think of as a foxhole, as mm-hmm. our fighting positions, to bunkers reinforced with logs we would go cut down in the jungle,
right.
Logs and sandbags to, They were reinforced fighting positions, basically.
Okay.
So we had gone, you know, from the basic all the way up to more sophisticated as the worries increased about attacks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, as I explained to you earlier, I pulled guard duty every other night, and it was standard. You would pull two-hour shifts during the night. And the American job, there would be two of us walking the perimeter. Our job was to make sure that the Mountain Yard guards were alert and paying attention to what they were supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we would walk the perimeter. There would be a Mountain Yard guard every 30 yards or so
mm-hmm.
around the perimeter. And our job was just make sure they're alert, you know, and to provide English-speaking communication to the command post if any incident happened, that sort of thing. We had two gigantic diesel-powered generators that ran these big lights,
okay.
almost like stadium lights, that would shine out from the perimeter. And that's... we had the jungle, at some point, I'm sure the CBs or some construction outfit had been in there, and the jungle was pushed back probably a quarter mile in all directions from the, from our base camp.
Okay.
So you had a pretty good view. It would have been real difficult to sneak up on us.
Mm-hmm.
Although they did it occasionally.
But, okay.
You know, they would make probes and that sort of thing.
Right.
Oh, one funny incident. The lights would attract these giant beetles. I mean, really huge beetles.
Right.
And the Mountain Yards just loved when I would be walking by. They would catch two or three of these beetles, and they'd yank their wings off. They'd keep them alive, but they'd yank their wings off so they couldn't fly, and they'd make a little hole in the dirt, and they'd put them in there until they had three or four of them. And then they just pop them in their mouth like candy and laugh like crazy. Then I would go, "Rrr."
Oh, man.
they thought it was cool.
Right.
Oh, another incident with the Mountain Yards.
Uh-huh.
I was not on this patrol, but had a patrol out. Basically, a patrol would be a company of Vietnamese soldiers, an American captain, an American lieutenant, an American sergeant, and then an American lower enlisted man to operate the radio, which would be a, you know, backpack radio.
Mm-hmm.
A patrol was out, found a female leopard with two cubs that had tripped a booby trap.
Huh.
And the mother and one of the cubs was killed. One of the cubs was still alive, so they brought it back in and basically turned it loose in the compound.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing was cute as hell when it was you know, a little kitten,
mm-hmm.
but became a total pain in the butt and started to grow.
Right.
Because it would get down in the drainage ditches as you come walking by, and then it'd leap out to attack you.
Oh, God.
And one night, the mountain yards got a hold of it and cut off its tail.
Huh.
And they hung the tail in their tent because it was good luck.
Okay.
In their culture, it was good luck. And so our doctor, and again, he was an MD, had to perform surgery on the cub because its tail was gone.
Right.
And we finally had to get rid of it. I don't know, it over to the zoo or turned it over to something.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't know, we put it on an aircraft and it went somewhere.
Okay.
I'm not sure where.
Right.
And speaking of pain in the ass, when I got there, we had three monkeys that lived in the compound.
Okay.
And they were a total pain in the ass. They would throw rocks at you. They would throw anything they could get their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I think they just took them out and shot them, got rid of them.
Right.
You think, you know, oh, monkeys are cute. Well, no way. Oh, another animal incident.
Okay.
I told you the Special Forces A-team was around in the, you know, the Mountain Yard Village where it was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was right on the river. And the way we had to get there was there was a cable strung across the river. And basically a barge attached to another cable. And you would load onto the barge. And then, you know, you would pull across the river. You'd mm-hmm. probably get 10, 12 GIs in there, you know, fully armed. Okay, I'm on like the third crossing. All of a sudden, the Vietnamese on the barge are going nuts. You know, rah, 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 rah. They're talking so fast I can't understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pointing, and I see what looks like a log coming down the river. And I'm thinking, well, they're afraid the log's going to hit the barge and overturn it or something. Well, then the log moved.
Mm.
A gigantic snake.
Wow.
It's like, oh my God, get us out of here.
Right.
I don't want anything to do with that.
Uh-huh. Right.
Anyway.
All right.
Made it to shore, everything was fine.
Okay. All right. Well, another question I have for you. You don't have to discuss specific names if you'd prefer not to, but could you, I guess, discuss some of the personalities in the unit, the guys that you were working with, if you could talk a little bit about that?
Most of the guys were from the East Coast or the South.
Okay.
I was the only one from California. The one I grew closest to was from Buffalo, New York. And, I wasn't really used to ethnicity. My dad always talked about growing up around Italians and Polish and, you know, different cultures. Well, I grew up around Swedes and Mexicans,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I knew.
Right.
So, my friend's last name was Gryss, G-R-Y-S, and going, what kind of a name is that? It doesn't have any vowels, you know? It's like,
right.
But anyway, I got exposed, you know, to a lot more. The southern kids and the eastern kids and that sort of thing. Although I bet I can't tell you anyone's name except Joe's. We seemed really close. Was not like, you know, the closeness of an American combat unit, it was not like that.
Okay.
Because we were, you know, we were pretty much interchangeable, probably from the 10, 12 guys, whatever there was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there would be six of us on any particular convoy or assignment or whatever. So, you know, we didn't grow close like an American combat unit, but we were, you know, we were good friends.
Mm-hmm. All right. When you first came in the country, how were you received? Was there any of the new guy treatment, or did things go well from the beginning?
No new guy treatment.
Okay.
In fact, I was a little surprised. Now, as you're transiting, like I said, I spent a day in Saigon and then a day in Da Nang. You know, the people working to process you through, they were kind of dickheads, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, they get tired of that crap, and that's a terrible job anyway, so
right,
that's probably why they were like that. But
right.
Once I got up to pontoon to the 22nd, you know, it was fine. And like I said, I always thought I was part of that unit. In fact, in my mind, I was part of MACV, the 22nd Advisory Group.
Mm-hmm.
And it came as quite a shock to me that I wasn't.
Right. Right. All right. Well, how was morale at that point?
Actually, morale was really good.
Okay.
I mean, really good. I mean, we were young. I'll bet we were at the whorehouse every other day. And basically, the mamas on it, the whorehouse, treated us like family. You know, it was, life was good.
Right.
I didn't have a whole lot growing up. I mean, I had enough to eat, and I had clothes on my back and stuff like that. But, you know, I thought I was living a good life.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
That,
go ahead.
You know, the French were in Vietnam before we were.
Right.
And they left behind quite a bit of influence.
Mm-hmm.
So Mama San at the whorehouse one day says, "I'm going to prepare you boys dinner." And we showed up, and it was a 7-course French dinner.
Oh, wow.
It was friggin' awesome. I mean, it was just unbelievably good.
Right.
And so she knew how to treat her customers.
Right. All right. Were you the group? Were you the only one that was the only radio guy there?
No. That's
okay.
What was so odd. Like I said, there were. I'm saying 10 or 12, kind of what I remember.
Okay.
And that's what we all, that's all of us, that's what was our MOS.
Ah, okay.
But we never did anything with those radios. They were up and running, and as long as they were up and running, they were fine.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Another thing, if you could talk, I guess, a little bit about your daily routine in Vietnam, if there was such a thing.
Let's see. Basically, guard duty was the most important. I mean, the night was the scariest because the VC owned the night and we owned the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the military is totally different now. Now Americans own the night, you know, with the night vision equipment that's been developed in the last few years.
Right.
But in Vietnam, it was the other way around. We owned the day, they owned the night.
Mm-hmm.
So the night was the most important. So that perimeter duty was the priority. And then during the day, they would have different things that they wanted you to do, or nothing. Like I said, some days we just hung out at the whorehouse.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I can remember, I am trust me, I am no electrician.
Mm-hmm.
I wired a building, and I'm going to say the building was the size of a small garage.
Okay.
I wired the entire thing, and I'm going, how did I know how to do that? I have no clue, but
right.
You know, that was a job they gave me one day.
Uh-huh.
All right, we want power to this building, and we want outlets here, and you know, bring it in from the generator. Hell, I did it. It worked.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
And trust me, there weren't many permanent buildings on site, and I can't remember what this one was intended for. I think it was the communications building. But like our command post was, you know, the containers that go on ships and then you put them on trucks.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it was an early version of that, covered with sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our command post.
Okay. All right. How about the convoy duties? How often would you go out on those?
Oh, boy. Probably at least once a week, sometimes twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
In the bad weather.
Okay.
Maybe less, maybe once a week when the weather was okay. Understand, we had a really tiny PX, if you want to call it a PX. Basically, you'd buy your cigarettes there, and you're shaving whatever you needed for that. A lot of times, we would have a pallet come in on an aircraft to play coup, and we would need to run down and pick up that pallet because the aircraft couldn't get into Khartoum.
Okay.
And then mail was just a priority, you know.
All right.
If we went, you know, 2 days without mail, you can guarantee there'd be a convoy to play coup on the third day to go pick a mailbag.
Right. So then the convoys were always between play coup and Khartoum.
Yeah, except for instance, when the Special Forces A-Team was overrun.
Right.
That was a different kind of convoy, much larger convoy, because typically we had no Vietnamese with us on our convoys down to play coup.
Okay.
Occasionally we would have air cover, and again it depended on the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't like us to go without air cover, but you know, you've been without mail for a couple of days, they say, okay, go.
Right.
We would go.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I gotta tell you about the air cover.
Okay, sure.
The advisory group was made up of all the U.S. forces. I mean, why we had Navy with us, I have no clue, but there was even a couple of Navy guys, a couple of Marines, some Air Force, mostly Army, but they would assign, and you got to remember, this is the early days of the war, so they didn't quite have it all figured out yet.
Right.
They would assign jet pilots on six-month tour duties to come in and fly our L-19.
Mm.
And you know what an L-19 is?
Yeah.
Single
right.
engine, probably 150 horsepower.
Right.
Well, these guys would be bored to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so I recall one particular convoy, we would sit on the outskirts of Khartoum waiting for the air cover to show up. And here comes the L-19, and he comes and he touches down on the road, he touches left wheel down on the road, goes back up, comes down, touches right wheel on the road, goes up, you know, just something to do because he's bored.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Oh, and then the Air Force guys weren't really, you know, trained for combat. So part of my job was to take them out. We had a place in the jungle that we used as a firing range. And
okay.
We'd made a berm there so you could throw hand grenades over the berm. And as I told you, I wore four hand grenades.
Right.
Basically every day. And because you're getting in and out of jeeps or aircraft, you don't want to have an accident, so you would turn the bottom of the handle up and then put a rubber band around it, so even if the pin pulled out, it wouldn't let the handle free. Well, I had probably six hand grenades in an ammo box, and you'd take the Air Force guys, they were typically captains, take them out, have them throw a hand grenade just so they have the feel of it.
Mm-hmm.
I had this one captain out, and I went through the routine. Okay, you hold it to your chest, you pull a pin, pull your arm back, and throw it. Well, I'm assuming everybody knows to take the rubber band off. He doesn't take the rubber band off. He pulls the pin, throws it over the berm. It doesn't go off.
Right.
He jumps up. Before I can say anything, he jumps up, runs after it, gets it, and brings it back.
Right.
That's probably the most dangerous thing he could do. But,
right.
You know, he was too quick for me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He probably wouldn't have listened to me anyway.
Mm. Right. All right. On these convoys, would you guys ever come in under fire from the enemy during these convoys?
I think we came under fire once.
Okay.
Typically, we, you know, it was bad, ugly road. Windy, kind of mountainous, you know, because you're going from elevation down to plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, we would do speeds of 50 and above, and basically that was to discourage being fired upon.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, as the year went along, I mean, hard to explain. Let's see. As I told you, we'd have a machine gun jeep in front, a machine gun jeep in back, and then whatever size our load was going to be in the middle. So it'd be a 3/4 ton truck or a deuce and a half. As the war started to escalate and get more serious, and there was danger of mines in the road or booby traps, that sort of thing, we sandbagged the vehicles.
Okay.
You would have sandbags on the floor, so any impact coming up from the road, hopefully the sandbags would stop something. And our greatest fear was mines or booby traps more than being shot. So we would typically sit on our flak jackets, and your legs would be protected by the sandbags, and your ass would be protected by the flak jacket.
Okay.
No seat belts, naturally. We had one incident. I was not on this particular convoy, but we had a kid from Puerto Rico that was always begging to drive, and nobody wanted to let him drive. Well, one convoy, they let him drive the 3/4 truck, the 3/4 ton truck, and he rolled it.
Oh, no.
And there were four guys in the back. I think four, maybe. Yeah, four, I think. No, three guys in the back, and he was the fourth. And basically scattered them all over the hillside.
Mm.
And we did have air cover that day, and I remember the pilot radioing in, "Oh, my God, they're all dead." They're, you know, well, they weren't.
Mm.
You know, a couple of them were injured seriously enough that they had to be medevaced in the train.
Right.
But, needless to say, that kid never got to drive again.
Right, right. What would be your job on the convoys? Would you do some driving or were you a guard or what?
I did both.
Okay.
I sometimes drove the jeep, sometimes drove the deuce and a half, sometimes manned the machine gun. It just depended. You know, early on, you know, when you, people don't really know you or trust you as much as they would later, I would basically just be a gunner.
Okay.
And later, you know, you drive. And I can't recall exactly how we figured out who was going to do what.
Right.
But I think it was the more experienced guys would be the drivers, you know, later on.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, if we could change gears here a little bit, if I could ask you a little bit about your impressions of the enemy and what interaction you had with them.
Early on, it was you know, my first tour was Viet Cong. My second tour was more NBA.
Okay.
Basically, we thought of them as little guys in pajamas who'd shoot you in a heartbeat if they had to. You know, just, I don't know, I didn't have any face-to-face with them that I was aware of. I mean, we always thought some of our workers, you know, we had females come on and do laundry. We had males come on the compound and do some mechanical work.
Mm-hmm.
We always figured they were spies or, in fact, Viet Cong. But, you know,
right.
How do you tell one from the other? You can't. So you always worked under the assumption were. And I learned to speak a little bit of Vietnamese, basically, with the interaction from them.
Mm-hmm.
My second tour, I had way more interaction with Vietnamese, and I learned to speak more Vietnamese at that point.
Okay.
I can't tell you what my impression of the enemy was. It's been so long ago. You know, I guess at night I thought of them as scary,
mm-hmm.
because they, like I said, they basically owned the night, and we didn't do anything at night except protect ourselves.
Okay.
Like we weren't in town at night. We, you know, in fact, nobody went anywhere at night unless it was a patrol out somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, and they were out for multiple days. Then they would be out overnight, but otherwise we didn't do anything at night.
Mm-hmm. All right. How often would the enemy attack or harass you guys there at the base at Kontu?
Oh, I'm going to say 6 or 8 times during my year. And it was basically harassment. We would have alerts far more often. And if I was not walking perimeter,
mm-hmm.
I was part of a team with a 30 caliber machine gun.
Okay.
And the team consisted of 3 guys. One guy had the tripod, one guy had the gun itself, and then one guy had the ammo.
Okay.
And we would, you know, we had a designated fighting position, and we would basically meet there and get the gun ready.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they would call alert would be a police siren, what you typically would hear now is a siren. So for years after that, I could not hear a police siren without my heart jumping, and you know,
right?
I mean, most Vietnam vets hear the clap of a Huey, and I do too. I react,
mm-hmm.
but I also reacted to the police siren because of that. I remember one particular night being so scared because you would not get dressed. You would just show up in your underwear because it's too hot to sleep with anything, winning clothes on. Some of the guys slept totally naked. I'm not sure how they responded, but I was so scared that something was really happening that I just began throwing up involuntarily. And, you know, I wasn't sick or anything. It was just pure fright.
Right. Right.
It must have been early in my tour.
Mm-hmm. All right. Would they normally harass you guys? Would it be incoming fire, things like rockets and mortar? Or?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Or, you know, sometimes it was rifle fire.
Okay.
Sometimes it was rockets, sometimes mortars. You know, they never killed anybody on the compound, so I'm not sure what the purpose was. I imagine it was just to keep us awake, mm-hmm. keep us alert to the fact, okay, we're out here.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see. Now, you also mentioned working quite a bit with the Montagnards. Could you talk a little bit more about them, I guess, about your impressions of them, and were they good soldiers, that type of thing?
Yeah. As a people, I thought they were really good people. They were loyal. They, for years, had been discriminated against by the Vietnamese, so they typically didn't like the Vietnamese, and because of that, didn't like the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that had a lot to do with why they fought alongside us.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that, you know, they were fierce fighters. And while the 22nd Arvin, that's who our team advised was the 22nd Arvin Division. While they had a terrible reputation, and you know, they would abandon their American advisors out in the field and run back to base.
Mm.
The Montagnards were the complete opposite, and it was a real honor for the Americans to have a copper bracelet presented them by the Montagnards. And basically, the ceremony was the village elves would take you. There's a name for it. I can't think of what it is, but it's almost like a clubhouse. It's the main building in a village, and that's where the men hang out, drink white rice wine.
Okay.
And they would invite you in, and you drink rice wine with them, and they would present you with a copper Montagnard bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a goal and an honor for the Americans to get their, you know, copper bracelets.
Mm, okay.
Be accepted by the Mountaineers.
Right.
Something else that just occurred to me, I can't for the life of me remember her name, but there was an American nun who ran an orphanage about 5 clicks out of Khartoum.
Okay.
And the Americans basically adopted her as a, we were her protectorate. And so we strung phone line out to the orphanage and gave her a field phone so she could be in touch with us anytime that was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would go out there, oh, probably once a month that I can remember, and maybe other guys went out there, you know, at other times. But, you know, we would take her supplies, and the doc would go out and help her check the kids, and that sort of thing.
Right.
She was forever in need of blood, so she was like a vampire. She wanted your blood.
Right.
So all my life, I'm pretty small, so all my life I'm usually too light to give blood, or my blood pressure's too low, so they won't take it. Let me tell you, she did not give a rat's ass. she threw me up on this table, stuck a needle in both arms, and took the blood. You know how if you donate at the blood center, they give orange juice afterwards?
Right.
She'd hand you a Bobby Bob beer. And she was quite the woman. Pat. Her name was Pat. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, she was a nun. And, I believe she was an American. I'm pretty sure she was.
All right. Aside from this, did you guys participate in any other type of civic action type programs?
Boy, nothing I can think of off the top of my head, Jason.
Okay. All right. Sorry. That's fine. How many kids did she have there at the orphanage?
Oh, I'm thinking in the range of 100.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, it was pretty common to have orphans.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think it's pretty common now.
Right.
I was online yesterday refreshing my memory of some of these things, and there are now 2 orphanages in Khantoum proper that are fairly large.
Mm.
And
right.
You know, that's a pretty common problem.
Mm. Okay. Right. Were these Montagnard kids?
I don't think she discriminated. I believe there were a little of both.
Okay. All right. Were they, I guess, were they primarily from parents who had been killed in the war, or people that were just, or kids that were just abandoned?
I think the majority were parents who were killed in the war.
Mm, okay.
But I also believe there were some halfies, you know, some half American, half Vietnamese type kids.
Mm-hmm.
That were abandoned.
Right. Right. All right. Let's see. Another question I had for you, if you could talk, I guess, a little bit more about just your impressions of the Vietnamese civilian population, and what was the relationship like with them? Were they friendly? Did they tend to be somewhat hostile, somewhere in the middle, or?
No, they were friendly.
Okay.
Like I said, when I got there, there was only 16,000 Americans in country, so we were still a novelty.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally the Vietnamese soldiers would not be friendly. And there were 2 reasons for that. The Americans did not have a lot of respect for their abilities or their motivation, but also the Americans hung around with their women.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like that.
Right. All right.
I think, in fact, I'm trying to recall the incident. I believe I was threatened by a Vietnamese Special Forces soldier. Because I had been with his woman, or what he considered his woman.
Right. All right. Since you arrived there fairly early in the war, before the majority of Americans had begun to come into country in the buildup, did you see, as your first tour progressed, could you actually see the buildup and things changing in Vietnam?
Well, it was changing as far as my unit was concerned.
Okay.
And I assumed those changes were going on around the country.
Mm-hmm.
As I told you, we became more and more heavily prepared. More expecting large action. And, in fact, if you're aware of Vietnam history at all, Khantoum around it, Doc To, and places like that were, I mean, big, big battles went around there.
Right.
War planners could see it coming, so we were preparing for it. It's just, I, I had gotten home by that time.
Right. All right. Well, did you hear much about some of these larger developments? How you mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin incident earlier. Did you guys get much information about that type of thing? And if so, yeah. What was your reaction to it?
Okay, the only source of news we had was occasionally Stars and Stripes would come in.
Okay.
And basically, it was whenever we did a mail pickup or an aircraft was able to get in with mail, then we had access to Stars and Stripes. And so we were aware. We were not necessarily aware of the implications. You know, GIs are worried about what's going on in their foxhole. They're not necessarily what's going aware, you know, concerned about what's going on in the war, even if it, in the world, even if it concerns them. Because, you know, you got things to worry about right here.
Right.
And, you know, in my adult civilian life, I'm much more aware of what's going on and how it relates to me. But, you know, at that point, I was just, you know, want to stay alive and have a meal and, you know, get some sleep.
Right.
It's amazing how important sleep becomes, you know, when it's not regular. I learned how to sleep anywhere on anything.
Right. All right. Would you, I guess in that case then, when would you catch your sleep? Just whenever you had a little downtime?
Right, right.
Okay.
And, let's say I was on an aircraft or on a truck where, you know, being a gunner was not my responsibility. I would fall asleep.
Okay.
I mean, you would just get sleep as you could.
Right. Right. All right. let's see. Did you get a chance to go on R&R during this first tour?
No. There was no such thing.
Okay. Too early for that then, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I something just occurred to me when I mentioned aircraft.
Okay.
It's hard to explain, but rules and regulations early on were, I don't want to say lax, that's not necessarily the correct term, but they weren't as strict as, you know, if you're on a military base in the U.S. during peacetime, I mean, there's all kinds of rules and regulations concerning dress and procedures and that sort of thing. Well, there weren't. I mean, I sometimes wore a camouflage uniform, sometimes didn't. It didn't matter what the uniform of the day was. It mattered what I thought was clean and what I put on that particular day. I carried several different weapons. I guess you would call some unauthorized weapons, but I had access to them and I carried them. Well, one of the things you were able to do is hitchhike on aircraft.
Okay.
And I had this incident where we had a second lieutenant was our boss, came to me and said, "You've been nominated for Soldier of the Month. You need to appear in Saigon on this day in khaki uniform."
Okay.
I'm thinking to myself, what? I haven't seen my khakis in 6 months.
Right.
I dug them out of my duffel bag and they're all moldy and crappy. So I gave them to Mama Sun, clean them up as best she could and get them pressed. Could not get a flight out of Khartoum, so I bought a ticket on Air Vietnam.
Okay.
And basically, it's an old C-47. There were people with chickens in the cabin. I mean, it was pretty hilarious.
Right.
And I flew down to Saigon. Well, as I told you, I thought I was part of the MAC-V 22nd Advisory Group.
Right.
This was the 178th Signal Company Soldier of the Month deal nomination board. I didn't know who these people were, and I didn't give a shit.
Right.
You know, seriously. And so I'm down in Saigon for a couple of days, and I've been before the board, and they didn't really think I was much of a soldier, so I wasn't named Soldier of the Month. And I'm thinking, I got to get back up to Kuntum.
Right.
So I go out to Tansanute Air Base, and I go to the operations shack, and I said, I need to get a flight up to Kuntum. And there's a C-130 warming up out on the ramp. And they said, well, go check with them. And I think they're going up to Pleiku. And so I ran out there and yelled at the crew chief. I said, I need a ride up north. You got room? He said, sure, hop aboard. We're going to Pleiku. I get on board. I'm the only passenger on the whole plane. There's no cargo. There's nothing.
Huh.
Just an empty aircraft and me.
Right.
And so go up to Pleiku. Well, hell, there's not even an operation shack. But I see a Huey getting ready to take off. And I run up, ask the crew chief, said, I need to get to Kuntum. He says, well, we're dropping some stuff out. I think you got in the Yidrang Valley, and we'll drop you back on our way back. We'll drop you off on our way back. And so basically I hit snow from Saigon.
Right.
It was really interesting too, because the flight on the 130 was pretty uneventful, but the chopper flight was definitely over a lot of hostile country, and we drew fire. We're flying along a creek bed, and all of a sudden the creek bed ends, so he pulls it up, and as soon as we pulled it up, we took it on fire. So typically in those days, the crew chief of each helicopter acted as its door gunner. Well, that meant there was only a gun on one side, so I acted as his gunner on the other side. Just even it out. But yeah, they flopped right into Kuntum and dropped me off. I don't know how else I've gotten back.
Right. Well, during your short time there in Saigon, did you get to do anything there? Did you get to see any of Saigon?
Oh yeah, yeah. Spent every night carousing around the town. Learned that, you know, Saigon proper was one place, and then Cholon, which you really couldn't tell the difference, but the Cholon district was the Chinese dominated area. A lot of East Indians in town, and in fact, they ran the restaurants, and I had a steak that I'm sure was water buffalo. Beef, but you know, just I think I was there two nights. I was probably out both nights, just seeing the sights. And you know, you could grab a taxi cab. Taxis were little tiny Renaults, in kind of cream and blue, and they were all over the place in Saigon. It was pretty easy to grab a cab and go anywhere you wanted.
Right. All right. Let's see. Well, any other memorable moments or funny moments, anything like that, from this first tour that stick out in your mind?
I think I've related all the high points.
Okay. All right. Well, then anything else we should mention at all from the first tour before moving on?
I think we've covered it, Jason.
Okay. All right. Well, so you went home, in, was it April of 65?
Correct.
Okay.
And I was assigned to a signal company at Fort Irwin, California, which is outside of Barstow.
Okay.
And I got there, and the company was packing to leave for, where else? Vietnam.
Right.
And I met with the CO at this time I was a PFC, so I hadn't gone very high up the ranks. Of course, I'd only been in 18 months. He said, you basically have a choice. You can, you know, check into the unit and go with us to Vietnam, or because you just got back, we'll assign you to the headquarters company of Fort Irwin. Well, I wasn't ready to go back at that moment. So I went ahead and took the assignment to the headquarters company. There were probably six of us, four back from Vietnam, two back from Korea. And they took us into headquarters company, but they didn't have jobs for us. So I was like, I was the post mail clerk for a while. I was, God, I don't remember what else I did. I basically didn't have a job.
Right.
So I, without a job, you don't get promoted. So I felt like I'd been a PFC forever. I'm there 6 months or whatever. The IG comes in on his inspection tour, as they do once a year. So I said, I want to see the IG. And basically went for him and said, hey, I think I got myself in a bad situation here. I don't have a job. I don't have an assignment. And therefore, I can't get promoted. Well, they said they would look into it. I figured that wouldn't go anywhere.
Right.
So about, let's see, I would have got there and I got home in April. I'm guessing I got assigned there in May. So I've been there 6 months, let's say. And finally, the place where I did the mail was next door to the reenlistment office. And the reenlistment sergeant was always on me. He says, I can take care of you, I can take care of you. So finally I said, well, the only way I'm going to get anywhere in this Army is to take a short and do a reenlistment. So that's what I did.
Okay.
And I got assigned to the induction center in Fresno.
Okay.
Which is basically where I was inducted. And met the woman who would become my wife. And you know, I knew I wasn't going to spend a whole lot of time there, but I was promoted to E4.
Right.
And then got orders to go to France. And let's see, I was supposed to report during the summer of 66, so I'm going to guess July.
Okay.
And so I proposed to my wife. I said, I'm being shipped to Europe. I'd like to get married in June. She agreed. As an E4, we got married in the oldest Catholic church in California.
Huh, okay.
Located over Monterey.
Right.
And the only reason we got to do that is because I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of the diocese in Fresno took pity on me and made arrangements. My wife is a staunch Catholic. I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Protestant. But, you know, I signed my life away that I'd raise all of my kids in the Catholic Church, yada, yada, yada. And he agreed. So he arranged it. So me and one of my friends and my wife and one of her girlfriends all jumped in my car and over there. The church was decorated nice because there was a big wedding right behind us. We got married, came home to a backyard reception, and then a couple of weeks later, I was on the USS Buckner on my way to France.
Right.
You have not lived till you spent 7 days on a troop ship.
Right.
That was awful.
How did you spend your time there? How did you pass the time?
Every other day you would get, I'd call it KP duty.
Okay.
And then every other day you were off.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally they would let you up on deck to get some fresh air. I remember I was off the day we went through the English Channel, and I saw the White Cliffs of Dover. Some of the guys had radios, so we got to hear rock and roll music.
Right.
You know, coming from Great Britain. And let me tell you, going over on a troop ship is not pleasurable. You know, the racks are six high. Somewhere in that six is you.
Mm-hmm.
You try and get some sleep.
Right.
And I don't do well on the ocean anyway. I don't even deep sea fish because I get seasick.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I wasn't seasick, right? But, you know, I was just not up for a cruise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the train ride, we landed in Bremen. And it was really cool how they did it. All of us assigned to France were put into one car.
Okay.
And that car was going to Paris. Well, you would go along, and the car would be traveling in this direction. And all of a sudden, you get the sensation that you're stopped, and then you feel the bang, and you're being switched to a different train. So I stayed on that car. Even though I was on several different trains, I stayed on that car the whole way into Paris.
Okay.
And then from Paris, was assigned to Orléans, which was the home of Joan of Arc.
Right, right.
And let's see. I was only an E4, so my wife was not eligible to travel with me. Although I was allowed to have her there if I paid her way. So we saved, I believe it took us 5 months to save enough for her to get over there.
Mm-hmm.
And because we were newlyweds and we didn't have anything.
Right.
Her friends would buy her, like, bath towels and stuff like that. She would box them up and ship them over to me, and I would stash them under my bunk. And if we had an inspection or anything, then I'd have to hide all these boxes.
Right.
And then my buddies knew that she was coming and that we didn't have any kitchenware whatsoever. So they would sneak utensils and plates and cups out of the mess hall.
Right.
So by the time my wife got there, I had a full set of military dishes that at least we could eat.
Right.
And it was funny, though. It was pretty obvious that De Gaulle was going to kick all the Americans out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really easy to get government housing because a lot of the American GIs had already left. So we were able to get a U.S. government apartment. We had government furniture. And, you know, with the stuff she shipped over and the stuff that the guys swiped from the mess hall, we were able to survive pretty well.
Right.
And I bought a 1956 Opel, and that was our transportation. I would, until I bought that, I would take the bus. The bus would come through the housing and take us to the concern, which was where the headquarters was. I was assigned to United States Communications Zone Europe.
Okay.
And part of my job was in the message center, where on one side of the wall were the cryptographers who would receive the message. They would transfer it into English. They would send it to our side. We would determine what was important, what was routine. The important stuff we would put into the reading file for the general. And every morning he would come in and go through the reading file.
Right.
And that's basically where I made all my rank. I got promoted to E5 fairly quickly. And then 6 months later, I was promoted to staff sergeant.
Okay.
Because... superiors really liked the way I operated. I'm kind of getting, I'm jumping back and forth because
I'm sorry.
Part of the time was in France and then the remainder was in Germany.
Okay.
When De Gaulle eventually said, okay, everybody out. We packed everything we owned, including a full-size poodle, into that 1956 Opel and drove from where we lived in Orléans to Mannheim, Germany. Mm-hmm. And I worked in Worms, which is Worms, but there was no housing available there because of the influx of Americans. So I got a government apartment in Mannheim.
Okay.
And it was like driving from night into day. France was bleak and dirty and dreary. Germany was colorful, bright, happy people.
Mm-hmm.
The French are pretty dour. The Germans are pretty upbeat and happy. And it was funny. It was, what? It was 25 years after the end of work due, 26 years.
Right.
And they seemed to enjoy us. They actually liked us.
Mm, right.
The French, not so much, even though we'd saved their butts.
Right, right. All right. So did you enjoy your time there in Germany then?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was funny. The housing where I lived, almost all of those people were in armor units, which were, you know, frontline units. Should the Soviets decide to attack.
Right.
So there would be alerts, and they would have to respond immediately and go to the field and disappear for weeks on end. I would respond to my headquarters, and after 2 hours would be released.
Right.
So there were many times in this whole village of Americans, I would be the only male around.
Right.
And so they, the women, I was pretty much in this one block of housing where we lived. I was pretty much the company daddy.
Right.
I remember one kid. He was probably 4 years old. Ran headlong into the radiator that provides heat and split his head wide open. So his mom ran and got me, and we took him to emergency and got him sewed up. And it's funny, I'm holding the kid while the doc's trying to sew him up, and the kid's screaming and squirming, and the doc goes, "That's all right, Sonny, your daddy's right here." I'm not this kid's dad.
Right.
And it was funny too. Is how to explain this? A long street with apartments on both sides, and the apartments would be in a horseshoe shape. So I'm not sure how many would be in there, but there's quite a few. And then at the far end, maybe a quarter mile down, would be the PX.
Okay.
And we would get paid once a month, so my wife would go once a month to do big grocery shopping. Well, that was also where the regular line troops lived. You know, the young GIs that aren't married.
Right.
You know, their barracks was down there. And my wife would walk along, and she'd get off the bus and walk along in her miniskirt. She was pretty hot looking.
Uh-huh.
They would, you know, be truckloads of troops that would just be going nuts over her, whistling and yelling.
Right.
She didn't like it too much, but I was pretty proud.
Right. Right. All right. Once you made the move from France to Germany, did the job remain exactly the same?
Exactly the same. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Right.
In fact, as I got promoted, I was in charge of one of the shifts. Basically, there were four groups, and you would run shifts 24 hours, around the clock. And by 6 a.m., you would have the general's reading file prepared. And I was promoted from just part of one of the shifts to a shift leader. And it was so funny. The first sergeant of our company, there was one staff sergeant stripe came available, and it was me and another E5 that were up for it. And I had 6 months in grade. The other guy had 15 years in grade. But the company first sergeant wanted me to get it.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty obvious when I appeared before the board. He's one of the board members. And as they would ask me a question, if he thought I wasn't sure of the answer, he would lean his chair back and try and signal me what the answer was.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean, it was pretty standard Army-type questions, you know. When did the Korean War end? It's separated by what parallel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, some Vietnam-related questions, that sort of thing. So I did quite well. I got the promotion.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty funny. The first, you know, when I was working, let's say, swing shift, I would eat dinner
mm-hmm.
in the base exchange. And I can remember the first night I walked in there. Like I said, I'm only 5'4", so all those stripes came down to my elbow. And you should have seen the heads turn the first time I walked in there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, we were enjoying our time in Europe, and I looked around at my future and. I got to thinking, well, what I should have done was applied for OCS and asked the Army to send me to college. But I decided I wanted to go to college and get a degree. I wasn't sure where I wanted to go with it, but, you know, I wanted to complete my college education, at least get a BA degree.
Right.
And so I did some calculations, and the only way I could make it out of the Army in time to start school in August 69 was to go to Vietnam, extend, get inside this 6 month window, get an early out, and then, you know, I would have time to, I would be short enough that I could get an early out and be able to start school.
Right.
So that's what I did. I volunteered for Vietnam, received orders to go in July 68. I'd extend a month to get into August 69. Once I was into August 69, I was within that six-month window of my regularly scheduled discharge. So I was able to get an early out and was able to start school.
Okay.
We came home. We actually spent a month in Fresno living with my wife's family before I headed out.
Right.
And she got a job, so she would, you know, she would be employed while I was gone. But she continued to live with her parents and, you know, save up some money. I was assigned. I wanted to go back out in the field so bad I couldn't stand it, but I was assigned to Armor Command Advisory Detachment, which was about 6 miles outside of Saigon. It was on the other side of Tonson Nhut Air Base.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Saigon area at all?
Yeah, I am. I've been there a few times, but
okay. Yeah. So you know where Saigon proper is, and
right.
You know where Tonson Nhut is.
Yeah.
And if the approaches to Tonson Nhut would be right over my head.
Okay.
The aircraft would probably be 300 feet in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's Armor Command Advisory Detachment was 4 officers and 2 enlisted men.
Okay.
It was a lieutenant colonel, a major, and 2 captains. And then it was a senior NCO and then a junior level NCO. And basically what it was, although Nixon had not announced the Vietnamization of the war, that's what we were doing in 68 and 69.
Mm-hmm.
We were taking U.S. armor and converting it to Vietnamese armor.
Okay.
Total waste of time, because armor is supposed to be mobile and hostile. And the first thing the Vietnamese officers is when they got their new tanks and their new APCs would be to plant them around their residence to protect their family.
Right.
So they were no longer mobile and far less hostile.
Right, right.
But it was basically I was a dog robber and a paper pusher. And I was told immediately upon arrival that I would be the dog robber. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with that term, is to go get what's necessary for the Vietnamese commander.
Okay.
So I've done things like I've traded two AK-47s for a fully prepared chicken dinner for 20.
Right.
I have almost everything I traded was either captured weapons or captured flags.
Okay.
And I would go, the easiest marks were on Long Bend Post.
Uh-huh.
Long Bend was about 20 miles away. Those poor bastards would spend a year and never get off that post.
Uh-huh.
Never.
Right.
And so I would show up there with weapons or flags or whatever, and they were just dying to trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would have really good luck. I would trade for sea rations. I would trade for lanterns. I would trade for, I mean, you name it, wall lockers, foot lockers.
Right.
You know, that's basically what I would do. That was part of my job.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of my job, because I had taught myself to type during my time in Europe, because that was part of my job, was doing paperwork for the lieutenant colonel.
Okay.
Yeah, but, I mean, there wasn't... That was probably 1/20th of my job, since there wasn't a whole lot to do, you know,
mm-hmm.
paperwork type stuff to do. So, and then I made the decision. I had the choice. I could live on Tonsa Nut Air Base, or I could live out with the Vietnamese. I felt... They needed some form of communication with American units. We had a unit of the 101st Airborne, probably three clicks down the road.
Okay.
And I made the choice to stay out there at night, and I picked me up a little place to live.
Hmm.
And every night I would do a radio check with guys at the 101st. And... I don't know how I became Yellow Hat, but that was my call sign, was Yellow Hat.
Hmm.
And I had no yellow hat, and I had no clue what it meant.
Right.
That was me. So
right.
I would check in with them every night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's, talk about harassing fire. I don't know if you're familiar with 122-millimeter Soviet rockets. Unreliable as hell.
Mm-hmm.
They would light them off and really not have a clue where they were going. Well, they would shoot at Tonsa Nut, and a lot of times they would fall on us.
Right.
I never had one hit right on me, but I mean, I've had one hit 20 yards away and slept right through it.
Mm, wow.
Believe it or not, you get so used to noise. As I said, we were like 300 feet under the aircraft.
Uh-huh, right.
And they're side-by-side runways. So there were constant jet noise. You just get used to it. The only really frightening incident is there was an ammo dump adjacent to us, separated by a concrete wall. I'm going to say 10-foot-high concrete wall.
Okay.
One day, one of the rockets fell in there and lit it off. So for like 3 days, that thing was going off.
Oh, wow.
You'd hear the shells. It'd be the back end of the shell that would fly over your head. You know,
wow, right.
Yeah. That was a little frightening.
Sure.
And the most fun I had there, this was not a fun job and not a fun year. Basically, I was married. I wanted to get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to survive, you know, get on with life.
Right.
But the most fun I had is we had an Australian armor unit come in and spend 3 days with us. And basically, they were going out in the field with one of the Vietnamese units we were forming, and they were going to do some training with it. So I got to spend 3 days with the Australians.
Mm-hmm.
What a great, great group of guys. Goofy, goofier than shit. So much fun.
Right.
It was, yeah, I mean, it was just fun.
Right. All right. Well, I have some follow-up questions to what you're talking about, but unfortunately, we've pretty much run out of time for today. Can we schedule a second session?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Earl Wright. Today is August 20th, 2010, and this is interview session number 2. Okay, last time when we left off, you had already begun your second tour, but if you don't mind, I have a few follow-up questions to something we were talking about last time first. After you got back from Vietnam that first time, while you were back in the United States, did you keep up with the war? Did you follow the developments and what was going on pretty closely?
Yes, I did. As you're aware, the buildup started just before I left,
mm-hmm.
and then continued for the next several years until it, you know, reached the 550,000 level.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was aware of the Tet Offensive of 68,
mm-hmm.
and then I arrived back in Vietnam shortly after that. So I did keep up with it, and especially still being in the military, you know, I wanted to know what was going on.
Right. What was your reaction to Tet?
You know, I have a more historical perspective on it now.
Sure.
But then I thought, Jesus, we were getting our ass kicked, and I was wondering why. Well, it turns out, you know, Tet was an actual victory for the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Was that me or you? Okay.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Tet, you know, was a victory for the U.S. We pushed them back in every place they attacked, and you know, they lost a tremendous amount of men in it. And is this a good time to talk about my philosophy on the prosecution of the war?
Sure, absolutely, if you'd like.
Okay. Obviously, I've had 40 years to think about this, and since I've been talking to you, I've thought about it a little more in depth.
Mm-hmm.
And this era was basically the formulation of what we now call political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was born out of liberal white guilt. You got to remember McNamara and the other advisors to Johnson on the prosecution of the war were in their formative years when we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm, right.
And so I believe, you know, in the typical white liberal guilt, they were not going to, you know, bomb North Vietnam back to the Stone Age, or you know, prosecute the war in a way that would have brought about a military victory.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were two ways to go in Vietnam: either all out war, kick the crap out of them and make them cry uncle,
mm-hmm.
or to do more like we did in the Congo. You know, the Soviets tried to establish a foothold in the Congo right after the success in Cuba, and we were able to go in there with special forces troops who basically blended in with the populace, and we stifled them at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
I think we could have done that in Vietnam. It would have taken more special forces troops, but I think either that or all out war would be the way to go. This kind of in between, trying to be politically correct, trying to be sensitive to, you know, we're fighting Asians, and we you know, dropped the only atomic bombs in that have ever been dropped. We dropped on Asians.
Mm-hmm.
I think that had a lot to do with it.
Right.
And when I got out of the service, my friends tell me now, well, you were an anti-war protester. And I say, no, I wasn't. I was protesting the way the war was being fought.
Ah, okay.
And I did not think it was right for my brothers to be over there putting their lives on the line.
Mm-hmm.
When we weren't going to fight to win.
Right.
You know, I marched in, I'm thinking back, I'm guessing it was Veterans Day parades with a group of other Vietnam vets, and basically we were not protesting the war. We weren't anti-war protesters. We were protesting the way the war was being fought.
Mm, okay. Right. In doing that, did you guys have run-ins with the anti-war protesters?
No, because I don't think they really understood.
Okay.
That we weren't part of them.
Right. Right. All right.
I mean, our group was a mixed bag. Sure, some of them were anti-war.
Okay.
But most of us, you know, we chatted. Most of them thought the way I was thinking.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, so the way the war was prosecuted with things like the bombing halts and limitations.
Right, and selected targets.
Uh-huh.
You know, we weren't allowed to bomb Haiphong Harbor, where most goods were coming in on, you know, Soviet ships. You know, there were two reasons for that. One is didn't want to get into the war with the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, everybody knows what's going on. There's no big secret here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are we tiptoeing around it?
Right. Right.
You know, we didn't bomb Hanoi proper.
Mm-hmm.
We bombed a lot of open jungle.
Right.
You know, thinking there might have been sickles. Loaded with goods headed south.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Okay. One other question I had for you before moving into this second tour. But before getting into that, was there anything else you wanted to say about at this point right now about your philosophy on the war?
About what?
About your take on the war.
No, I think I've pretty much covered it.
Okay. Well, I have some more questions regarding that towards the end of the interview, but we can cover those later.
Okay.
One other question I had, day before yesterday when we were talking, you were talking about how things weren't necessarily laxed in Vietnam, in the units that you were in, but it wasn't quite the spit shine army. Things were a little bit more lax than they were. Once you got back to the States and were in the, you know, still in the army, but not in Vietnam. How was that? Was there any difficulty adjusting back to, I guess, the type of spit shine army with all the rules and regulations that go on with that?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, it was basically understood, and I think the GIs of today even understand it. You know, there's reasons for, you know, acting this way in Iraq or Afghanistan, for instance, and there's reasons for acting this way at Fort Hood.
Mm-hmm. And, right.
And I think those reasons are made pretty clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You touched on this a little bit yesterday, but once you arrived back in Vietnam, could you talk a little bit more, I guess, about the unit that you were assigned to and the duties that you would be doing?
Okay. When I first got back and I was processing in, I told the captain if I had my druthers, I'd rather go to the field somewhere, you know. And he looked at me kind of cross-eyed and said something to the effect of fat chance, and assigned me to Armor Command Advisory Detachment.
Okay.
And I explained that was just outside of Saigon. So it was on the opposite side of Tonsonute Air Base.
Right.
The city of Saigon, in a place called Govap.
Mm-hmm.
G-O-V-A-P, but it's pronounced Goyap. When I got there, they told me the majority of my job would be a dog rubber. And basically, my job was to get access and obtain things that our Vietnamese counterparts wanted or needed, and I would trade captured weapons, flags, that sort of thing, things that the average GI on Long Binh Post, for instance, would never see.
Mm-hmm.
It's your duty. So I would make numerous trips there and swap captured weapons flags for items we needed, or they items that the Vietnamese had requested.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I had a choice of whether to sleep on the airbase itself in U.S. barracks, or to stay with my Vietnamese counterparts. I chose to stay out on the compound with my Vietnamese counterparts, basically to provide them English-speaking access to U.S. forces if necessary.
Hmm.
The Armor Command compound had been attacked and overrun during Tet 68.
Hmm.
Quite a bit of evidence of that left when I got there.
Okay.
In fact, I rescued... I think there's called a garrison flag. It's the U.S. flag with the fringe all around it.
Okay.
I rescued that. It had been through the battle and had been pretty well neglected until I got there. And so I brought that home with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had several offers of people want to buy it. And,
right.
I won't let it go.
Right. Well, a question about the about your job as the dog robber. Any particularly memorable or humorous type trades that you made? What type of things were the?
Yeah, there was I don't know if you're aware of the typical command structure in an advisory group.
Mm-hmm.
But usually the American counterpart would be one rank lower than the Vietnamese counterpart.
Okay.
So, for instance, if the highest rank in America was a lieutenant colonel, normally the highest ranking Vietnamese would be a full colonel.
Okay.
So we had a lieutenant colonel, and his counterpart was a full colonel. The colonel was going to host some other Vietnamese officials, and he wanted to have a dinner party, so I traded two AK-47s for a fully prepared chicken dinner. I was trying to think of the unit that I made the swap with,
mm-hmm.
and I can't remember, but I dealt directly with that unit,
uh-huh.
told him what I needed, and I told him what I'd give him for it. And so... I went and picked it up. It was all prepared. It was in hot containers that I could carry back.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very pleased.
Right. All right. Any other memorable trades?
No, just pretty pretty inconsequential stuff. Sea rations,
uh-huh.
Lanterns, wall lockers, foot lockers. It would be pretty mundane to the average person.
All right. And so basically just the essentials and things that, that the Arvin needed to continue.
Right.
Okay.
That they couldn't get through normal channels.
Right, right. Okay. All right. Well, could you talk a little more, I guess, about your impressions of those Arvin that you're working with? I know you talked about yesterday how they weren't really, or day before yesterday, about how they weren't really aggressive. But
No, I mean, in fact, in reading some of the history, my first tour, you know, was the group I was with was advising the 22nd Arvin Infantry Division, and they had a pretty lax reputation. My second tour was to convert U.S. armor to Vietnamese armor, typically at the company size.
Okay.
And that would include, you know, an M48 tank, probably 2 to 4 M113 armored personnel carriers, which would be, you know, they would be armed, and they would have a 50 caliber machine gun in the front, and then on the sides, either 230s or 260s, M60s. And, you know, armor's supposed to be hostile and mobile. And they would typically take it and implant it around the commander's villa and, you know, make them stationary weapons. And, you know, I would hear from the advisors that would be assigned to them, and, you know, the advisors would be trying to get them out in the field, and they would pretty much refuse. Now, not all of them. I mean, some of them were really aggressive, and they would, you know, go storming through the bush with their new toys, but
right.
Not all of them. I would say the majority were not aggressive.
All right. Was part of the advisory effort there and converting them over to the Arvin, was part of it also training them as well? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that, usually, and it would be at the company level, it would be a major, a captain, and two NCOs, and they would be their advisors as well as their trainers.
Okay.
And that's usually where I got my feedback, was from them. You know, they would come back and say, well, this is working or this isn't working.
All right. In general, how was the relationship between the Americans and the Arvin?
Generally, I would call it good.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know, Americans are used to immediate solutions. Sometimes the solutions wouldn't be immediate, and there would be a little frustration. But I would say generally good. I mean, my relationship was excellent, and I think that's because I chose to live out there with them. I lost a lot of weight because I ate a lot of Vietnamese food, which didn't quite get along with my American stomach, but I came home weighing 108 pounds.
Wow.
As hard as a rock, but
right.
And then I had some sort of, I don't want to call it a skin disease. It was more like mushrooms growing in my body because my shower, the only way I could shower is it was an open water tank that would be heated by the sun, and you'd let it get warm enough, and then you could take a shower. Well, obviously the water had not been purified, so I had a fungus growing on me when I got home.
Right.
It was, you know, it was really easy to get rid of.
Right. All right. Well, how about go ahead.
One thing you might find interesting, since you're married to a Vietnamese and spent a lot of time there, because my stomach had such a problem with their food, it was pretty typical for me to to have a fifth of Johnny Walker Black on hand, and I would that would be my dinner gift,
right?
And right, because it's $4 a bottle,
mm-hmm.
and I would chase the food with the Johnny Walker, hoping it would kill any, you know, microbes that might be growing.
I know the feeling. I know what you mean. Right.
Have you eaten that stuff that it's like gelatin, only it's not colored? It's, I want to say the color of putrid, but that's not really a color.
Mm-hmm. I believe... Go ahead.
That and NipMom I couldn't handle.
Yeah, the smell is a little overpowering. My wife still will cook with it occasionally, and I have to leave the house.
Now, she doesn't chew betel nut, I hope.
No, she doesn't.
You know, that's how you could tell the women were over 20,
mm-hmm.
and the teeth were black.
Right. Yep. Oh, yeah. Oh, well, how about aside from the shower, how about other living conditions there with the Arvin? How were the living conditions overall?
Pretty primitive, but I mean, I had a bunk. I can't recall what the bathroom conditions were like. I remember the shower, but obviously it wasn't too bad.
Mm-hmm.
I did learn to throw my art far, far away. If, for instance, I ate some sea rations,
mm-hmm.
occasionally I would eat sea rations.
Right.
And at first, pitch the garbage in a garbage can like we do now.
Mm-hmm.
But the rats were so huge.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, just huge.
Right.
And I did not like them sharing my living space.
Uh-huh.
So... I would make sure I pitched the garbage far, far away.
Right. Right.
And we did have, I don't know if they were chameleons or what. I had a number of lizards living on my wall.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Want them because, you know, the mosquitoes would be just overpowering.
Right.
And they help keep the mosquito population down.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, living there, making the decision to live there with the Arvin, I guess that takes a bit of trust to do that. Did you trust him?
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, it was hard to tell good guys from bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I had... I don't know why I had relationships with at least three of them that, you know, I knew their names and my names. We would talk daily, and I did. I grew to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
They had all been in the field at one point in their career. They were military,
mm-hmm.
and they had all been in the field at one point in their career. We did have a female translator that worked with us, but she did not choose to live on base, which I can't blame her. She lived,
right.
in Saigon.
Right.
And they would transport her back and forth by Jeep.
Mm-hmm. Was that your... Go ahead.
Excuse me?
Oh, was that your primary way of communicating with them, or had your Vietnamese gotten good enough at that point? Or?
Well, I picked up enough Vietnamese, and they picked up enough English that we communicated, and it was just basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to the point where they even would be able to joke around with me.
Right.
At one end of the compound, the Arvin soldiers' quarters, so their families lived over there.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was a billy goat, a big billy goat, that would just roam the compound.
Mm.
And I remember FCC just loved to get the billy goat to butt. And he would go up and he'd put a boot between his horns and that would get him fired up and he'd go around butting whatever he could find.
Right.
And they thought that was funny. You know, that was great fun.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
And then I told you about the ammo dump next door getting hit by a rocket, and it spent like three or four days exploding.
Right. Right.
I mean, they didn't even try and control it. That was it's too dangerous to even try and control. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Outside of that, were there many attacks from the VC or the NVA?
You know, we were never the target. It was always Tonsnud Air Base and the aircraft that were the target.
Okay.
But as I said, the Soviet 122 millimeter rockets are just notoriously bad.
Right.
And so there would be short rounds falling on us, short rounds falling on the ammo dump. I would describe my second tour as noisy.
Okay.
I mean, constant aircraft. They were, you know, 300 feet overhead.
Mm-hmm.
Occasional explosions in the middle of the night. Honestly, I would sleep right through. You just get so used to noise. It
right.
doesn't startle you.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
Now, an interesting fact. I'm sure only a few people have done this. Because I was on the opposite side of the airbase, if I wanted to go in to Tonsnud Air Base for anything, I had the choice of driving all the way around into Saigon and then coming in the main entrance,
mm-hmm.
or I go around through a rear entrance, pull to the runway, look both ways, cross that runway, stop at the other one, look both ways, cross that runway, and then put my Jeep into the pattern of taxiing aircraft, and then pull out on a road.
Right.
I mean, something you would never hear of now. I mean, it would be just absolutely a no-no.
Right.
But, you know, hey, it was war, and I guess, you know, a lot of the rules didn't apply. So.
Right. How many was that? Where the other American advisors, did they live at Tonsnud or?
Yeah, the officers lived in hotels in Saigon.
Okay.
The enlisted men lived in barracks on Tonsnud Air Base.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And in fact, my replacement, I was quite proud of him. My replacement, when he showed up, said he and the lower-ranking enlisted man, which I didn't have the whole time I was there, I had a part time I was there, would live with the Vietnamese.
Hmm.
So he established quarters in the quarters I vacated for both he and the lower-ranking enlisted men.
Right.
He also thought it was important,
mm-hmm.
You know, to establish relationships as well as provide English-speaking voice for, you know, the radio.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So would the officers and the other enlisted, would they come over in the morning and leave in the evening?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
All right.
I wouldn't guess there were too many times they worked a full day either. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was pretty lax.
Right, right. About how big was the advisory team there that you were a part of?
It was six.
Six, okay.
Four officers and two enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I believe the TO&E called for seven, which would have been four officers and three enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
But it was only six all of my tour, and I think it was only six as I left. It was a lieutenant colonel, a major, two captains, a senior NCO, and a lower EM.
Mm-hmm. All right. And could you talk, I guess, a little bit about the different jobs that they held, about what all the different assignments that the team had, what they would be doing?
It was all an advisory role.
Okay.
And all of them had basically the same job. It was convincing the Vietnamese that we were operating in their best interest, forming Vietnamese armor units, and trying to get those units into the field.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The equipment would come in with American markings. We wouldn't do the actual physical work, but who was changing it over to Vietnamese markings,
mm-hmm.
Getting it on their books, and taking and forming the actual unit, the manpower part of the unit,
mm-hmm.
and then sending it somewhere into the field.
Right. Right. All right. Was there any frustration among you guys, among the Americans, as far as the Vietnamese not using the armor the way an American unit would?
The four officers that I worked with rarely shared any of that type of frustration with me. I mean,
mm-hmm.
who am I? I'm a staff sergeant.
Right.
The guys that would actually be assigned to the units that were sent into the field, they would occasionally return and express frustrations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, how, from what you could gather from living with the Arvin guys there, and from your day-to-day interaction with them, how would you say, how was their morale from what you could see?
You know, it was really hard to detect morale. They could not or did not complain about their living conditions because they didn't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
They were at least assured of having their meals and a place to stay and sleep, where I'm not sure if they would have been civilians in Vietnam, they would have been guaranteed of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You understand? I mean,
right.
The Americans being there allowed them to be certain of, you know, three meals a day and a place to sleep and a place to have their family.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And I know, obviously, later on after you got back, not to jump too far ahead again, but since you made the decision to essentially protest against the war because of the way it was handled, had you given much thought to it at this point? I guess what I'm asking is, at this point in the war, how did you, from your perspective, feel things were going, and did you think that this program of Vietnamization and turning things over to them was going to be successful?
No, I thought I was a loser then.
Okay.
It was pretty common that between the American GIs it was a given that the war was not being prosecuted properly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody from the lowest ranking GI that just got there up to, you know, the highest level I would deal with, all thought it was stupid that we were trying to fight with one arm tied behind our back. Nobody had any confidence that Vietnamization would work. Basically, we're soldiers and take orders and do what we're told.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I thought Tet was a loser, mm-hmm. when in fact it was a winner.
Right.
And I had that gut feeling. I say, you know, this is American military. We don't lose.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we didn't. You know, we lost public opinion.
Mm-hmm. Right. So by this point, then, in your second tour, did you come to the realization then that things were not, that it was not going to end with a victory?
I had not come to that realization, but the realization was that it was not good.
Okay.
We were not doing what was necessary to win.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
And you got to remember, Jason, my two tours were like two different worlds.
Right. Right.
Totally two different worlds. I mean, I arrived there in 64 with 16,000. My brother and I in country, and I arrived there in 68 with 550,000 in
mm-hmm.
country. Yeah, big difference.
Right. Right. Could you, could you see, I guess, witness a difference as far as the American presence and how it had changed the war and how it affected Vietnam? Could you see it?
Yeah, I think I felt it more than my first tour, you get on Highway 1, you wouldn't see another American until you get to play Coup.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, going from Govap to Long Bend, that's all you see is American presence everywhere. I'm not sure. I believe the Vietnamese enthusiasm was greater in my first tour than my second tour.
Mm.
And it was not that they didn't want us there. My second tour, it was the novelty had worn off.
Mm.
And, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure to them it seemed interminable.
Right. Well, that brings up another question that I've thought about before. With your work with the Arvin, I'd like to ask you this. I've seen where some historians and people who view the war from hindsight at this point have said that one of the things that may have happened was that early on, that perhaps the Arvin were, in some case, as you said, you know, more the enthusiasm was there and were more, perhaps even more committed. But once the Americans fully got involved, the Arvin were in some ways kind of pushed aside. We're going to take over the war, and the Arvin at that point kind of stood back. Do you think that's an accurate portrayal?
I mean, that could be,
mm-hmm.
but understand I wasn't involved at that level.
Right.
That kind of assessment.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it makes sense to me, you know. Early on, we say we're going to be your advisor, and here, go fight this way. And we show up with 500,000 troops and say, okay, we're going to start kicking butt. Then we say, the American people aren't really behind us. We're going to start turning it back over to you.
Mm-hmm.
I can see where their enthusiasm might be dim at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, changing the subject a little bit, I guess. How did you spend your free time and things like that during this second tour?
Basically, it was a routine. I would, around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, I would jump in my Jeep. Like I said, it was three clicks down the road to, you know, to the 101st Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go, I'd buy three beers.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go back to the compound, write my wife a letter. As I said, I was married during
mm-hmm.
this tour. Either make a tape or write a letter.
Right.
Have my beers and go to bed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'd usually do a radio check just before I went to bed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this second tour, then, it was much more of a... Was it much more of a daily routine then?
Yeah, and we discussed this a little bit during the first part of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
my first tour, I was 18 years old. There weren't a whole lot of Americans there.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun.
Right.
A lot of fun. My second tour, I was married. I was older. I'd made the decision to get out of the service. It was routine. It was no fun involved. It was just routine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was basically, okay, what do I need to do to make sure I stay alive and get home?
Right. All right. Well, discussing the routine, could you talk about, I guess, a typical day and how it would be structured?
If the colonel had some paperwork for me to do, I would obviously hang around and do whatever needed to be done. If not, sometimes he would get word from his counterpart, the colonel in charge, or I would get word to the enlisted Arvin troops that I'd be around. We'd like to have such and such. Can you see about getting it for us? And so sometimes I just jump in a jeep and take off,
mm-hmm.
and go seek what they wanted.
Right.
Sometimes, most times I was successful, sometimes not. Sometimes I'd have to search a little harder.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But I tell you, drive into Long Bend Post, and you get within the perimeter, and the farther inside you get, you come upon MPs in full dress uniforms wearing white gloves, blowing whistles, directing traffic.
Right.
You know those guys never get out into the war, so if you show up with artifacts that have been captured, they're going to want to trade.
Uh-huh. Right. Right. And with these weapons that you were trading, were they coming from the Arvin?
Correct.
Okay.
And they would know who I was, and they would channel them to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And the drive up to Long Bend, was it a fairly safe drive?
You know, I never felt threatened. Anybody who's been in a war zone is hyper alert when they get back. Well, I was hyper alert, you know, on the drive to Long Bend.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I would be by myself. Sometimes I would have Arvin accompanying me.
Mm-hmm.
I was always armed. I felt like I knew what I was doing and was prepared. Like I said, you see U.S. troops everywhere, so I didn't feel completely exposed.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
I guess, you know, it was like my first tour. If they wanted me, they could have had me.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't a prime target, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. How long of a drive was it?
This is best guess.
Okay, sure.
From an old guy memory, about 20 miles.
Okay, right. It would be. Would part of it be going? Would you actually go through Saigon?
No.
Okay.
You would angle off. I can't remember what the road or the highway was. You would go through Govab, and then if you're going to Saigon, you'd Y to the right. If you're going elsewhere, you'd Y to the left.
Okay.
Y to the left, go through a little bit more of the village, and then out into the countryside, which was rice paddies all the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, anything else about the actual job we should cover that we haven't?
No, it was pretty mundane stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, did you get a chance to go on R&R this tour?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Met my wife in Hawaii.
Okay.
That would have been April 1969. And I was just amazed at how well I was treated. We met in Honolulu and caught a flight to Kauai, where we spent the week in Kauai. And I rented a Mustang convertible.
Right.
And we had a great time. Well, one evening we were going to dinner at this certain place, and, you know, it was a little before dinner, so we stopped into a bar.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat at a table. A few moments later, somebody walks in and says, "Who has the Mustang convertible out there?" And I stood up and said, "I do." He said, "Well, it's got a flat tire." And I go, "Oh, darn, okay, I'll head out to change the tire." They would not let me change the tire.
Huh.
It was obvious. I was real tan and short hair. It was real obvious as a GI on R&R from Vietnam.
Right.
They would not let me change the tire. All the guys jumped up from the bar, and the guy who had spotted it, they all went out and changed the tire. They came in. I was going to buy them around for them doing that. They would not accept it and then bop me around.
Huh. Wow.
Around.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Right.
Just treated so well.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't run
and,
in.
And that's not what I was expecting, because you'd heard all the crap. This was 68 and 69, right?
Right.
You heard all the crap going on in the States. So much different.
Right. So you didn't run into any of that negative treatment at all?
No.
Oh, wow. No. That's right.
I was just so tickled.
Mm-hmm. Right. Was it a week R&R?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. How much time did you have left in your tour whenever you took the R&R?
Let's see. It was April, and I extended a month, so May, June, July, August, 4 months to go.
Okay. All right.
During that time, I told you my intent was to start college to get within 6 months to get an early out and start college.
Right.
I had to take the ACT.
Okay.
And the only way to do that was to go to special services at Tatsunit Air Base.
Huh.
And they would schedule it. So I actually took the ACT at Tatsunit.
Huh, right.
Which allowed me to walk right out of Vietnam onto the campus of Fresno City College.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Okay. While you were there, those last 4 months, anything else we should discuss? Any memorable moments, funny moments, anything like that?
I told you the Australians showed up.
Uh-huh.
And they were hilarious.
Right.
Two or three days with us. And they actually brought their tanks and their APCs into our compound and basically camped out there. And, you know, their tanks were British tanks, which I'd seen photos, but I'd never really seen. So it was interesting to look at their equipment. And it was interesting to sit around at night, almost like camping out, listening to their stories. And they would harass each other just like typical American GIs do.
Right.
And, you know, if you get past the accent, they aren't that much different than we are.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I firmly believe that Australians, and this is, you know, even history from after I got out of the military, but I actually believe Australians are more like Americans than any other peoples anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. So you spent about, you said about 3 days with them?
Yeah, something like that.
Uh-huh. All right. Any other, did you ever have in either of your tours interaction with any other nation soldiers from other countries, like the Philippines or the Koreans or anything like that?
You know, I saw Koreans, not really to interact with them, but you know, you go on Tatsunoot Air Base and you see everything.
Okay.
I mean, it was, I'm thinking it was my first tour. I saw an aircraft that I didn't recognize, and it was a British aircraft of some sort.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, anything else from that second tour we should discuss before talking about coming home?
No, I mean, basically the second tour was spend a year, stay alive, and get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, once your Deros came up and it was time to go home, what was your feeling? What was your feeling about going home?
I was really excited. I was a little nervous of, you know, geez, I'm going to be out of the military. I've been here almost 6 years. It's kind of the only adult life I know. But I was enthusiastic about starting school, enthusiastic about getting home to my wife. You know, typical worries. You know, how am I going to make a living? Is the GI Bill going to be enough to live on? That sort of thing.
Right.
And am I going to be able to complete my education in 4 years?
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you experience any of the the short timer syndrome of being a little more paranoid towards the last few days, or no?
Yeah, but there wasn't a specific threat, so I didn't go through what U.S. combat troops might have felt.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, did you have that experience at the end of your first tour, the short timer session?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
You know, it's I know it's so hard to for somebody to grasp, but it was the first tour was just fun. Everything mm-hmm. we did was fun. It was either fun or extremely frightening, like you're on a roller coaster, which is extremely frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when it's over, boy, that was exhilarating.
Right. All right. Let's see. Sorry, I forgot the question I was about to ask.
That's all right. That's all right.
I'm sorry about that. All right. Well, was there any sort of, I remember now, was there any sort of out processing? If so, how long of a process was it?
Yes, there was. It took place at Oakland Army Terminal, and it seemed interminable.
Mm.
But it was about, I don't know, about 27 hours, I guess.
Mm.
And basically, those of us out processing, we were awake and sitting around waiting a lot more than we were out processing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they did pay you and release you, it was such a great feeling of relief. And obviously, we're all in uniform and heading for... I had to go to San Francisco International Airport to catch a flight home to Fresno. And so, I know I shared a cab over there. I can't tell you with who, but just, you know, a bunch of guys got together and shared a cab.
Right.
I was a little apprehensive of how we were going to be greeted in our uniforms, but there were really no incidents.
Mm,
I mean,
that's good.
Just got in, got a plane ticket, got ready, boarded the flight. I was really, really proud of my wife and my mother, who somehow got access onto the air terminal at Fresno, which you, it would be impossible to do now. But right. They rolled out a red carpet for me.
Oh,
right,
wow.
Below the ramp. Yeah.
Right.
And probably a half a dozen of my friends and relatives were there. And so that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. So then it was a good homecoming then?
Yep, yep.
All right. And at that point, when you were completely out of the Army at that point?
Yes.
Okay. All right. How long did you take off before you started into college?
Less than a week.
Less than a week. Oh, wow. Right.
It was, I can't remember the days exactly, but it was like I got home Thursday and started school Tuesday.
I mean,
it was
wow.
Really, it was just, I walked out of Vietnam onto the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Just boom.
All right. And what'd you major in there at Fresno City?
Well, this is interesting. I had no major.
Okay.
I had not a clue what I wanted to do. So my first semester, I took a current class because my thought process was, well, I've been living it, so this should be a fairly easy class.
Mm-hmm.
The instructor of that class I liked a lot, and he was the advisor to the school newspaper. And I thought, well, I worked on the school newspaper in high school. I wasn't a writer or anything, but I sold advertising or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, I like this guy. I'm going to take this as a class next semester. Well, the first day of class, he said, does anybody here like sports? And you got to remember, this was 68-9 era. Lots of protests going on. Sports, you know, wasn't very popular.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the only one in the class that raised my hand,
mm-hmm.
which I like sports. And he said, good, you're the sports editor of the Rampage this semester.
Right.
I had nary a clue what I was doing. But it turned out that led to a time job at the local daily newspaper, writing sports all through college. And that became my major in my career. I was a journalism major.
Oh, wow.
Turned out I'm a great writer.
Right.
I'm a good reporter. I'm a good editor. And that's what I did with the rest of my life.
Okay. And did you cover sports or move into other
yep.
things? Okay.
Yep. Not my whole career, but all through college, I covered sports.
Mm-hmm.
And my first job away from here was not sports, but turned out, you know, I've had hiring and firing responsibility for probably the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And sports writers actually make the best reporters. Mm-hmm. And I cannot tell you why, but I think it's because of sports is about detail. And so sports writers tend to pay attention to detail.
Right, right. are you still involved in the newspaper business now? Or?
Jumping ahead. I was in the newspaper business for 27 years. I've worked at 7 different newspapers all over California.
Okay.
Drugged my wife all over hell. But as the news media became more and more leftist with liberal thoughts. That did not fit me.
Right.
So in 97, I gave it up, started my own custom publishing company. Basically, I produced newspapers and magazines for specific clients, which was fine until the housing crash of 2008. Devastated California.
Right.
And all my clients were broke, and so I went broke with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've pretty much closed up my business and semi-retired.
Okay.
And that's why I have time to spend time with you.
Right.
I had college kids work for me, and so my few remaining clients I just turned over to them because, you know, they didn't need me. They were, you know, they were well-trained and knew what to do. So this gives them something to generate some money to get them to college.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, I didn't mean to jump too far ahead there.
That's all right.
Well, another question I had for you, was it during this time at Fresno City College that you became involved with, not anti-war protests, but protesting against the Whig
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there was, it was real obvious who the veterans were, because we were all, you know, 22, 23 versus the 17 and 18-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
So we would, you know, during break, get together and have coffee and that sort of thing and chat. And all, you know, we all had different experiences, but we have all had the same thought: is, gee, we can't win if they won't let us fight correctly, or what we thought needed to be done.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. And I guess, how active were you guys?
Not that active. It was pretty much a loose group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of them did go on to form an anti-war faction that, you know, joined the other anti-war efforts
mm-hmm.
on campus. And later, when we moved, you know, I did 2 years there and then went to Fresno State for 2 years.
Okay.
You know, some of them moved into that. I did not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was not anti-war hippie. Although, I didn't get a haircut for 3 years.
Right.
And I had my hair pretty far down my back, but that was not because I was an anti-war protester.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. What kind of activities would you guys be involved in?
I recall marching in a particular Veterans Day parade.
Okay.
And the signs we carried were related to not letting us fight.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, we also attempted to carry a U.S. flag upside down, and that was our thought of, you know, we're in trouble.
Right.
We don't do this correctly. And this will tell you we were not true anti-war protesters. The organizers brought a chaplain from World War I. So this guy was old.
Right.
And he asked us, would you please turn the flag over correctly? And we did.
Uh-huh. Right.
Nobody was going to tell this old chaplain that we were, you know, up yours, we're going to carry it the way we want.
Right.
We complied with his request.
Uh-huh. Right.
That tells you right there we were not true anti-war protesters.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you have other people that, I guess, kind of misunderstood your purpose and tried to lump you guys in with the anti-war?
Oh, hell yes, hell yes. You got to understand, I was, my classes, once I got to Fresno State, my major was journalism, so my classes were with you know, people who run newspapers throughout the West Coast now.
Uh-huh.
And they all say, Earl, you were an anti-war protester. I said, no, I wasn't. See, you don't understand.
Right.
And you know, they're big-time lefties and Obama supporters. I am not an Obama supporter.
Mm-hmm.
I was not a John McCain supporter.
Right.
But, you know, one of the reasons I got out of the business is like, I have a friend who runs a very large, influential newspaper in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And I ask him, how can you sit there in the news budget meetings and make decisions with your biased thought process?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I'm not biased. The hell you're not. You are.
Right.
You know? And they are. And trust me, they're my friends. I love them dearly.
Mm-hmm.
They are just so out to lunch when it comes to seeing the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they hang around with people who think that like they do. They go to universities who teach like they think.
Mm-hmm.
And So they never get out of their little sphere.
Right. Oh, right.
In fact, they've made the rule, but it goes out the window. In fact, I'll be leaving here in a month for a four-day camping trip and three-day golfing trip. We spend a week together, and we fish and golf, and I am not allowed to talk politics. Well, that goes out the window real fast.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. That's one of the themes today about the media and that bias. Was the bias prevalent at the time that you got into the newspaper business? Did you Did you realize that as you were getting in?
No, I didn't. Let me tell you an incident that happened when I worked up in Redding, California, and I worked up there from 79 to 85, so you can kind of gauge the time period. I was the assistant city editor, and I was sitting with the city editor, and we were going through resumes because we needed to hire a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes to a resume where a young man had put down his Air Force career as well as his, you know, short newspaper career.
Mm-hmm.
And the city editor turned to me and said, "Now, why would he put that on there? Like, it was useless." And I'm going, "This guy's a fucking idiot. Excuse my language, Jason."
Right, sure, no problem.
Exactly what I thought.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just, you know, I was frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, I look back now, Army taught me so much about leadership. It taught me the military is the last true meritocracy in America. It doesn't matter what color you are. Sure, there are incidents of racism, but as an institution, the Army only sees green, the Air Force only sees blue, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm sorry, I got off on a tangent there.
No, that's
I started to go far afield.
That's quite all right. That is quite all right. All right. After you, as you're going through college and you're preparing for your career, are you still following the war in the media? Are you still paying very close attention to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, understand, I worked a lot. I not only worked at the newspaper, a friend of mine had an air conditioning business, and I was kind of gopher for him. And then in the summers, I would work in a peach cannery, you know, canning peaches, because
mm-hmm.
the money was great. But I did. I mean, I took a newspaper, a daily newspaper, read it every day. I watched the news if I didn't happen to be working. And I did. I was interested.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept up with it.
Right. Well, along the lines of what we've just been talking about with the bias in the media, what was your take on the media's coverage of Vietnam as you were reading the newspapers? As you were reading it, did you think this is a load of crap, or did you tend to agree?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And it just irritated me to no end that I was being trained to write straight news with no opinion in it, and I would read stuff that was allegedly straight news that would have opinion in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, once you're trained that way, it's easy to pick out. And even with the nightly news on CBS, you know, it was fairly easy to pick out.
Mm-hmm.
And that would irritate me to no end.
Right. All right. Well, as things in Vietnam began to wind down, and eventually with the fall of Saigon, of course, what was your reaction to the way things concluded?
Basically, I'm watching and going, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe this is happening. You watch the videos of the helicopters landing on top of the embassy, and then landing on the aircraft carriers, and they push the choppers over the side to make room for the next one, and you go, holy shit, what is going on? I don't know, I felt a sense of loss. I mean, why are we giving up? Why are we quitting? What the heck has happened to the U.S. military? You know, I also felt for, the Vietnamese that I'd grown close to.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is going to happen to them? Especially like, I'm thinking like the NCOs that I hung around are the NCOs. Okay, they have the potential to be able to take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But what about our interpreter?
Right.
I mean, she's a female, 22 years old or whatever, How is she going to survive?
Right.
They're gonna just kill her, devastate her,
mm-hmm.
make her prisoner, send her, to a camp.
Right. Right.
So I did have concern.
Mm-hmm. All right. Before wrapping things up in the interview, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a few more of these few broad questions about how the war was handled and some of those type issues.
Okay.
All right. First of all, we've touched on some of these things a little bit, but looking back on your experiences, looking back on the way Vietnam was handled, how do you feel about American involvement in Vietnam to begin with? Do you think that we should have gotten involved in Vietnam?
Okay, if I had to pick a strategy,
mm-hmm.
I would pick the strategy more like we did in the Congo.
Right.
I would send special forces troops in, and we've apparently done this a lot in Afghanistan and Pakistan, although Pakistan's not advertising.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I would have done it more that way.
Mm-hmm.
The people did not necessarily trust the South Vietnamese government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's similar to the problems we're going to have in Iraq, where the government is not necessarily trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically seeing dollar signs, and they're just going to take as much as they can and, screw the country.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go live in Paris.
Right. All right. Well, how do you feel about your own service?
I'm damn proud of my own service.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. I hate people like John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
I have no respect for Kerry. I despise him. I will long enough to piss on Jane Fonda's grave. And the reason I despise John Kerry is I completely understand how he got his three Purple Hearts. My first tour in Vietnam, I did far more to deserve some sort of award, and I was awarded the Army Commendation Medal, and I was shocked
mm-hmm.
when they had the award ceremony, and I got it. My second tour, I was awarded a Bronze Star, and I go, what the hell is this for? And that was, that overall mentality was how Kerry got his awards,
mm-hmm.
and basically he awarded them to himself. I'm not saying I awarded the Bronze Star myself, but it was you know, my lieutenant colonel, going, good job, and giving me a Bronze Star. I go, wow.
Right. Right. All right.
I've had the opportunity in the last, let's see, I'm going to guess it was the mid-90s. No, it had to be early 2000s to get to know some of the former POWs from Vietnam.
Mm, oh, really?
And, yeah, we had a premiere of the movie Return with Honor.
Okay.
And a guy who'd become a friend of mine was the commanding general of the 140 Fighter Interceptor Wing that's out of Fresno.
Okay.
And he had asked me to be part of his group putting this on, this premiere of this movie. And as part of it, we brought in five POWs.
Hmm.
And one of them was Charlie Plum, and he stayed overnight at my house.
Oh, wow.
I hosted him. And they're such fine people.
Mm-hmm.
And to go through what they went through is just heartbreaking. And you think about all the guys with, you know, with severe PTSD, and then I'm rambling again.
No, no, not at all.
But are you aware that a judge recently ruled that the Stolen Valor Act is invalid?
I did hear that. Yeah.
Because it's freedom of speech to claim you were awarded, you know, medals that you were not awarded or don't deserve. Well, stuff like that just irritates the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And we have beggars on the street corners who claim to be homeless Vietnam vets.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they're not. They're not.
Right.
But, you know, what can I do about it? I've talked to the Fresno PD about, hey, let's start picking these guys up under the Stolen Valor Act. Well, now it's been ruled invalid, so, you know, it's really
right.
Frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Sorry to be a rambler there.
No, hey, not at all. Not at all. All right. Next question. What's your opinion of U.S. policy towards Vietnam today and modern Vietnam? And what do you think about, I don't know, trade, business, that type of thing, and veterans going back?
I wholeheartedly support it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a sort of connection. A friend of mine, ex-wife, now works for an entity out of Fresno City College, probably similar to your entity.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the trade representative. This is a big agricultural area, so ag trade is a big deal. And she works very closely with Vietnamese here, and they have established relationships in Vietnam and, you know, enhanced trade between this area, which I mentioned has a large Southeast Asian population, and Southeast Asia. And I wholeheartedly support it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Have you ever given any thought to going back yourself?
Yeah. I took my wife to Hong Kong just prior to the conversion of Hong Kong, which I think was in the late 90s. God, my memory's zapped. Anyway, she didn't really want to go to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted to kind of show her what it was like, I mean, the weather, et cetera.
Right.
So I took her to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
That's as close as we got. Now, I would go back to Vietnam myself.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to go, you know, just bumming around in Kantung province and just see what it's like.
Mm-hmm. right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything else that we haven't covered before wrapping the interview up?
No. As I've grown older, my opinions have become more firm, and you know, I obviously believe I could have done a better job of prosecuting that war than the people who were in charge. But I have a fat chance of being elected, so I guess my lot in life is to just complain about it.
Well, I guess I will go ahead and bring the interview to a close, but